Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it is always a pleasure to welcome to a university campus a man of distinctive achievement and daring innovation, especially if he's accompanied by his charming lady. Indeed, I must say, that's about one of the few pleasures left open to a university president these days. It would derogate from the achievement of our honored guest today to give you a detailed accounting of what he has done. You're all familiar with it. You may not be aware of the fact that Colonel McDivitt is a graduate of Kalamazoo Central High School. Also, and I can say this without fear of violent reaction, in this day of ecumenical understanding and tolerance, he holds two degrees, one earned from the University of Michigan. But he tells me that as a young man, he did come to the Michigan State campus frequently, enjoy the football games here, and might even have attended Michigan State University had not the Air Force provided a free ride for him at the University of Michigan. A personal note, Colonel McDivitt, I have particular admiration for your courage and daring, because for the last 26 years I've been married to a woman who's scared to death of commercial aviation. It is with distinct pleasure and pride that I present to you one of the great pioneers of our time, Colonel James McDivitt.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Adams. I appreciate some of your remarks. It's a real pleasure to be back here at Michigan State. As Dr. Adams said, I did spend a lot of time up here back in the old days, 47, 48, 49, 50, when Michigan State was trying to get into the Big Ten, and I always supported an underdog. Now, I have many fond memories, although I never attended school here, I have many fond memories of coming to the football games and the activities afterwards, and I do I do notice that the campus has changed a little. But it is really a distinct pleasure to be here today. I understand you've already seen the Hollywood version of what our flight was all about. And while that is not absolutely accurate and is a little overdone as far as the glamorous portion of it is concerned, it is a fairly true representation of our flight. I would like to say just a few other words about it that might clarify some of the things that you saw in the movie. And that might express some of my personal feelings about your responsibilities. Now, one of the things that is shown in the movie that I think is very hard for a mere earthling to comprehend is the size of that booster when it's launched or as it flies through space. It's roughly 375 feet tall, which is about a 35 or 40 story building. I don't know the height of the tallest building here on the campus or in East Lansing or Lansing, but I suspect it doesn't go over that height. That's pretty good size. And it Turns out that it weighs about 6.6 or 6.3 million pounds. It has five engines on the bottom that put out 1.5 million pounds of thrust each for a total of 7.5 million pounds. The booster that I rode on Gemini 4 a few years back had two engines in the first stage. They put out a total of 430,000 pounds, so that each one of the five engines that we have now is roughly four times more powerful than those other two combined. So it's really quite a vehicle. I was talking to Dr. Von Braun the other night, and we were trying to estimate the horsepower that the thing put out, somewhere between 150 and 160 million horsepower at liftoff. And it's like putting a destroyer on end and then putting it in orbit. Well, in that movie, if you can remember the picture of its flight as the rocket plume expanded. And by the way, that wasn't animation. Those were all real movies. If you can recall, the width of that plume just before the first stage burned out was probably 500 or 600 feet. And I would guess, although it's not all, the whole plume wasn't present on one frame of the picture, that it was probably a half a mile long. So that's a pretty good sized fire. The flight itself was really a two-phase flight. We could have almost landed in the middle and taken off and started all over again. That the difference between the first 5 days and the second 5 days was that great. The first 5 days had two primary objectives. The first was to demonstrate that the lunar module was spaceworthy. This was the first manned spacecraft that we had flown as far as the lunar module was concerned. Only the third one built, and only one other had even been in flight, and it was a very stripped down version. The other lunar module, LEM-1, was a spacecraft that had propulsion systems in it, one or two radiators and a few pipes and some plumbing, and that was about it. It was not a complete spacecraft by any stretch of the imagination when we flew it. So we had the first one, and our job was to test it to see that all the subsystems really worked. We didn't have any real problem with it. And if we were successful in doing this and showing that it was spaceworthy, then we would embark on the second objective, which was to demonstrate that we could actually operate two spacecraft in flight at the same time. Up until Apollo 9, we'd only operated with one manned spacecraft with one set of controllers on the ground and just tried to operate that way. And we found that to be quite a gigantic task. Well, on Apollo 9, we had two spacecraft that were manned simultaneously, sometimes docked together, but sometimes separated by as much as 100 miles, in a group of ground controllers. Now, to communicate with each other, we had to talk from the command module to the lunar module, from the lunar module to the ground, and the ground to the lunar module, and we had a million ways of communicating. So it was a real job to get the information that we actually required for flight from one vehicle to another, and back to the ground, and back to the spacecraft, in those few minutes where we actually had communications between all three legs of our operational triangle. But we were able to do that also, and it was quite successful. The reason that we were able to achieve some margin of success was that we were able to simulate on the ground for some weeks in advance the exact mission that we flew. And sometimes I actually believe it's more difficult to do the ground simulation than it is to fly the spacecraft. Because when you get the spacecraft up there, you just have the spacecraft and the spacecraft and the ground, and that's all you have to worry about. But when you're trying to simulate it, you have a simulator that has about, well, they vary between 5 and 7 very large digital computers. Then we have another simulator with 5 to 7 large digital computers. We have to tie those computers together so that one simulator knows what the other one's doing. We have to tie all that back to Houston, from Cape Kennedy back to Houston, so that we can run a simulation with the people that are really going to control the flight back there. And they have another 50 or 60 computers. So when you try to tie all this together, it's really almost an unwieldy mess. But we did it. And because of all the groundwork that we did prior to liftoff, we were able to achieve a reasonable amount of success. What happened after the first 5 days? Well, we sort of embarked on a different kind of mission. We put the LEM in an orbit all by itself, unmanned, an orbit that's about 125 by 4,000 miles, and it'll probably be up there for another 20 years or so. When we did that, that was the end of the first real phase of the mission. After that, and I should say we had accomplished almost 100% of the mission objectives at the end of the first 5 days. But we weren't content to just sit back on our laurels and coast around for five more days. So we did some experimentation with things that we hope can help us learn more about good old Mother Earth. We took a number of pictures of the Earth in different frequency spectrums that would allow us to look at only certain colors on the Earth. We took color-shifted IR photographs of the ground that would allow us to determine what the currents were in the oceans, what the growth rate was in certain fields, to determine the usability of space photography to determine river courses, not only now, but what they have been over the last thousands of years, to investigate some of the uses of this type of photography for geology. We tracked other satellites in Earth orbit. We even tracked our lunar module, and we're able to see it at a range of 2,800 miles in the daylight with no artificial light or anything, using one of the telescopes that we had on board the spacecraft. So we really had these two phases. One was the dual mission, the dual spacecraft mission, and the other was a single spacecraft Earth resources type of mission. Now, about a year and a half or 2 years ago, we were embarked on a real major redesign program in Apollo. We had a fire, a real catastrophe. We were trying to redo the spacecraft. We made many changes. We were probably at a very low point, I guess, in our public relations, certainly, and in our space achievements. But we didn't let that stop us. We went right on and did the things that we knew were necessary to make our spacecraft capable of successful flight. In the last 6 or 7 months, we have flown three extremely successful space flights. We've been around the Earth with one spacecraft, we've been around the Moon with the same spacecraft, and we've been around the Earth with two spacecraft. And May 18th, we expect to go to launch a flight that will go around the Moon with both spacecraft, although it won't land. So we made tremendous strides in the last 6 months. And that, again, is built on a very good, very solid technological and scientific base. But I think I'd like to say something to you all. I have a chance on many occasions to talk to small groups of young people, but I don't usually get an opportunity like this to talk to so many at one time. I'm going to be 40 years old, although my wife kids me about being 39 and holding. But I'm going to be 40 years old this summer, and I'm not going to be flying in space until I'm 90. I hope not, anyway. And somebody else is going to have to do the job when I leave the space program. And we've got some young guys that are 30, and in 20 years they'll be 50, and I know darn well that they're not going to be doing it. And the space program's not going to be over within 20 years, and it's not going to be over within 30 years, and it's not going to be over within 100 years. So we need some good people to do the job. Whether you're an astronaut, or whether you're a program manager, or whether you're a program director, or whether you're a technician, or whether you're an engineer, or anything, or whether you're the business manager for the thing. We need some good people to do this. And those good people are going to come from people just like you. And something that's been sort of bothering me in the last year, although I must admit that I've been much more wrapped up in getting ready to fly this space flight than I have in other problems that the country's faced with, is the chaos that I see invading our schools. I'm sure that when I went to school, things weren't very good, and we did take some measures to correct the problems that were there. And I'm sure that there are things here at Michigan State, University of Michigan, and any other school in the United States that probably aren't just as they ought to be. But there's certainly a framework of law and order in which these changes can be made. Now, I don't really think that it's the responsibility of Dr. Adams or the faculty to keep order at the school. I think the schools are really for the young people. When I went to school, I thought it was for me. But I certainly had a framework of law and order in which I requested changes to be made. And I certainly encourage you people to make sure that the majority indeed rules and that you rule within a framework of law and order. Because if we have chaos in our schools for the next year, or 2, or 5, or 10, the United States, as we know it today, is not going to be in existence in the year 2000. because I'm going to be long gone and I'm going to be too old and decrepit to do anything constructive anyway. But I want to make sure that there's somebody behind me so that when I do go and I look back at the United States and I look back at our flag, and I still have something to be proud of. So I sort of depend on you. Don't let me down. Now, I have a few other things to say about the flight and space program in general. I think we're right on the brink of a number of breakthroughs that can indeed help us to learn what the Earth's resources are from space, either from manned or unmanned satellites. As I mentioned, we got some data from photographs and from some other experiments that we did in flight that really, I think, will help us to get over the threshold and into something really constructive as far as learning what old Mother Nature does. I have a picture that we took in flight that I've seen many times. It's a classic example, I think, of the kind of information that we can gain from this kind of work. It's a picture of the Salton Sea and the Imperial Valley and the All-American Canal in the northern part of Mexico. And it shows, in these color-shifted photographs, things that are foliage don't appear as green as they would to the naked eye. They appear as red. And the blues that we'd see with our naked eye don't appear at all. They just come out black. There's no sensitivity in the film to blue at all. And the greens appear to be blues, and it's all shifted. So when you first look at it, it looks like a mess. When you study these things for a while, you can actually tell where we are using good farming techniques, where we have blights in our forests. We don't have to have a forest ranger run around on a horseback looking at each tree. He can go out, we can take a photograph from space, and he can look at these things and says, this part of the wood, he can say, this part of the woods really has a problem. Go out and take a look at it, and maybe we've got a pine beetle or something like that. But we've got data like this, and it all shows up in this one photograph. I wish that I had a picture the size of that screen to show you today, but one of the things that's really interesting is it's a picture of this Imperial Valley, and the All-American Canal defines the border between the United States and Mexico. And it clearly shows that the crops are either different in the United States in that particular point, or we have a different technique for farming, because the foliage, as shown in these red photographs, is so much greener to the eye, or so has much more growth. We can't tell that the crop is better. We can't tell that the yield of a bushel of wheat per so many square feet is better, but we can tell that the foliage is much greener, is much fuller. And I think that by looking at these things and studying these things in many years in the future, we'll actually be able to predict what the crop's going to be in a certain country, what the crop's going to be in a certain state, what a certain crop like alfalfa, what it will produce over the years. So there are many facets of this technology that we're developing that we can get into, aside from manned spaceflight. However, I still think that manned spaceflight is by far the most interesting. I think it's the most enjoyable. I think it's the most challenging. I think that this applies to not only the people that are flying it, but also the people that are working on it. Now, I have some time that I'd like to make available for questions on our flight or any other aspect of spaceflight that you'd like to know about. And I'd be willing to tackle anything that you can offer. I believe there are two microphones in the back here that you might avail yourself of. And that way everybody will be able to hear what the question is. Yes, sir.
I understand there are about several dozen astronauts in training right now in the United States. For one thing, I don't think there are enough rockets for all of them to fly. Do you believe that the space program will be continued so that all of the astronauts will eventually fly?
Yes, I think it will. Now, I must say that we don't. When an astronaut is selected, he is not guaranteed a flight in space. We select the number of astronauts, and we have had some who have not flown because of medical problems. Also, we direct our space program without regard to the individuals who may be assigned to a flight. We select the flights and their objectives based on what best we can do with the equipment that we have and how best we spend our money and what the objectives are that we can achieve. Presently, we have 52 astronauts assigned to the space program. Obviously, if we divide that by three, which is the crew presently assigned to an Apollo program, we are not going to have enough space flights in the next 5 years to fly everybody. However, we have many other space vehicles under consideration right now. One is a large orbiting space laboratory. This could take a crew of 12 or 20, and then you have to have a large nucleus of trained astronauts. You can't send 20 people up that are all new, or at least we try to avoid that. So I think that as we watch the space program develop over the next 5 years, we're going to see that those people are well utilized. I think it's also a point that may have escaped a lot of people that there are more than three astronauts assigned to each crew. We have nine astronauts assigned to each flight. We have a prime crew, which is the one designated to fly the mission. We have a backup crew, which is the crew designated to fly the mission in case anything happens to the prime crew. And we have a support crew, which doesn't even train to fly the mission, but acts under the leadership of the commander of the prime crew in doing the kind of things that in the old days, when we didn't have such complicated vehicles or missions, that the prime crew itself did. We have a lot of procedures that have to be written. We have to test the spacecraft. We have to make sure that the peripheral equipment is ready for flight. And it's just impossible for three people on a prime flight crew to do those kind of things. So we depend on the support crew to prepare the spacecraft and prepare the procedures and those things for us. So I think that we're going to utilize all those people. It's funny, we have a shortage of astronauts because we can't assign nine guys to each crew. In just three crews, we've used up 27 people. Yet, on the other hand, we don't have enough flights for everybody, so they're sort of at odds with each other. Yes, sir?
Sir, I'm interested in the qualifications men have had getting the flight program.
Certainly. The qualifications that are required depend upon whether the man is being selected as a pilot astronaut or as a scientist astronaut. If he's selected as a pilot astronaut, as I was, it's the criteria so far has been a degree in engineering or some scientific field. You have to be under 6 feet tall, or 6 feet or under. You have to be in good health. You have to be able to pass one of our physicals, which is quite a strenuous physical. And you have to have a minimum of 1,000 hours of jet flying time. And now a lot of people meet these requirements. So we select the people by personal interviews, by written tests, by recommendations of their superiors, either in the military or in the civilian organizations, and we then have to select from them. The scientist astronauts do not have to have ever flown an airplane, although we have had some selected that were already pilots, but they have to be leaders in their respective fields. And these fields can be anything. They can be geology, meteorology, medicine, just about anything.
You said you didn't want to make predictions, but still hoping. Do you think there's any future for our Navy in space program?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I do believe there are. And I think in the last selection, there were some Army aviators under consideration. Now, when I say 1,000 hours of jet time, obviously that we usually apply that to fixed-wing aircraft, and the Army doesn't have any jet fixed-wing aircraft that I know of today. But I think that then we would look at the qualifications of the person. What we're really looking for are skilled pilots, people who are able to handle a dangerous situation, not panic, be able to coolly perform the duties that they have to do. And I think that I fly helicopters, too, in addition to the fixed-wing airplanes, so I appreciate the things that the Army pilots are doing. I think if you're capable of flying a helicopter through a test program or something like that, you're certainly qualified to fly in space. Certainly. Yes, sir.
What kind of feeling do you have from being separated from the only craft that you get back on Earth? What feeling do you have when you're away from it?
Well, I try to avoid that feeling. Well, I wouldn't be telling the truth to say that I wasn't concerned about it, because we all were, and it was obviously a critical point in the mission. But we'd had a number of critical points that led up to that. It's just one of those things that when you're going to launch, you know you're going to get on top of that thing that weighs 6 point something or other million pounds, most of which is fuel, and most of which either burns or blows up. So you've faced a number of these things, these crises prior to that time, and I guess we had a lot of things to do, and we wanted to do them right, and I knew the best way to get back to where I started from, which was the command module, was to go out and do the job the way it was supposed to be done. So I thought about it, you know, it just flashed through my mind, what if I don't get back? Well, that's the chance that we take, I guess. So we just got in the spacecraft and went out and did the best job that we could. Yes, ma'am. Would you say that again a little louder, please? Are there any black astronauts in training? No, ma'am, there aren't at the present time. We have selections that we don't select one person this year, another person next year. We select in groups. There have been Negroes who have been involved in the selections. I think, I know there was one involved in a selection in about, the year escapes me, 1964 or something like that. He wasn't selected at the time. The reason, the selection process that we use, as I mentioned earlier, is to set a certain criteria. And then we take those people that meet that criteria, and then we try to select the best of those people, regardless of the color, the race, the creed, or anything like that. I was the first Catholic astronaut that was selected, but I wasn't selected because I was a Catholic. And when we select the first Negro astronaut, he's not going to be selected because he's a Negro. But we're going to have the best ones. So far, we also don't have any lady astronauts, I should say. Much to the chagrin of many ladies. Pardon? Is there a very large opening for the people in the space program? Yes, as a matter of fact, well, right at the moment, it depends on how the budget comes out in Washington. The space program is like all of the other things that the United States can do, has the capability of doing. There's a certain amount of money that's available, and we have to take our turn along with the many other things that are worthwhile. And quite often, as the budget is spelled out, we have to compete with this money. And then when we get it, we are able to determine what our capabilities are for the next fiscal year. And if we get hit real hard in the budget, they put a ceiling or a freeze on hiring in the NASA portion of the space program. However, the space program is not only the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. It's all of the industrial power behind the whole United States. I should mention that one of our spacecraft was made by Grumman Aircraft Company in New York. The other one was made by North American Rockwell in Los Angeles. Our guidance system was designed by the MIT Instrumentation Lab. It was built by AC Sparkplug. International Latex, which makes ladies' underwear, built our pressure suits. And the whole United States is involved in the space program, including you, because you probably pay a lot of taxes. Yes, I can't do it today because I don't have time. But if you would really like it, if you write to me at MSC, Houston, Texas, I'll get the letter and I'll send back an autograph. Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
So, given all the complex photographic equipment on the spacecraft, were there any reconnaissance photos taken over Russia during your flight?
No, as a matter, first of all, we don't, on our flight, we didn't have very sophisticated photographic equipment. We carried three 70-millimeter Hasselblads that you can go down and buy in a local photo store. They're pretty expensive, but we carried three for general photography. One was a super wide-angle lens, and the other had two standard lenses. Then we carried four other Hasselblads, 70-millimeter cameras, in this experiment I told you about. We took basically one-to-one pictures, the same picture that you would see if you just looked out the spacecraft window. And then we carried the two movie cameras. So the equipment we had was not very sophisticated. We did not fly over Russia at all because our orbits only go to about, well, our flight was as far north as a U.S. spacecraft has ever gone across the Earth. And it was to a latitude of about 33 and a half degrees, I believe. So it didn't go very far north. NASA releases all of its photographs, and I wouldn't put them in a class of reconnaissance. We take pictures of the ground all over the world. They're available to everybody, and I think that the NASA space program is a wide-open space program and is completely separated from the kind of reconnaissance that you would associate with the military.
There, thank you, sir.
Certainly. Yes, sir.
Sir, what is the line for the Mars probe? Is there any presently in view?
I can't hear you very well. Say that again, please.
What is the future of the Mars probe? Is there anything past or Apollo?
Oh. Okay. What is the future of the Mars program? Is there anything past Apollo? Well, we're studying the Mars mission. I don't want to go on them because it takes a year to get there and get back. So. there are going to be a lot of things past the Apollo program, one of which is just more exploration of the moon and large Earth orbiting satellites and things like that. Now, the Mars mission is still a study program. We're not building hardware for it right now, and I don't think that we're going to be building hardware for it for a few years. What it really means is another generation of launch vehicles and spacecraft. We don't have a booster right now that can boost us out and put us on a trajectory for a Mars mission in a spacecraft that's capable of getting there and getting back. So we're faced with just a design problem right now, and we don't have the funds to do it. These things are tremendously expensive. So right now, the Mars mission is a study program only.
Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir.
How much and how long does it take to build a limb?
How much and how long does it take to build a limb? Well, I worked on this particular mission for 2.5 years, and at that time, we started working with LEM-2, which was a spacecraft just before ours, and then we elected to not fly that and fly LEM-3 instead. Well, I think LEM-3 was in existence, at least the outer structure of it was in existence when I first started working on the mission, so it takes over 2.5 years to build one. Now, how much does it cost? Well, that's a very difficult question to answer, because if you took all the money that was spent at Grumman Aircraft Corporation to build lunar modules and to do the testing of the components up to that time, and then divided it by the number of flights that we had, well, it would probably be a billion dollars or more. Actually, the value of the booster that I had, the spacecraft that I had, and everything was estimated at from about, oh, I think it was $800 million to a couple $1 billion that we were responsible for. Now, that's a tremendous responsibility just as far as the dollars go. It'd be a shame if we had to abort off of it at 6 inches off the ground. But it would be kind of hard on me, too. It's kind of hard to tell how much one spacecraft costs. They're very expensive. You couldn't buy one today. Yes, sir. Okay, I think you said, why don't we have something to back up the ascent engine? That's generally the case. What happens if the ascent engine doesn't fire and you're on the lunar surface? Well, that's easy to answer. You just stay there. Now, some things are very simple in the space program. People try to complicate them too much. A lot of people have spent a lot of time and energy looking at space rescue. And to date, my opinion is the best way to have a successful space rescue, is don't have one at all. And how do we do that? Well, we take and we build a spacecraft that we're going to go into space with as good as we possibly can. We look at the possible failures where a single failure can cost the life of the crew. And we put some redundancy in there. We make two of those where we can. And we build the thing as reliable as we possibly can. Now, admittedly, we only have one ascent engine, but we have two helium bottles that have pressurized helium in them that we can pressurize the fuel and oxidizer tanks with. We have dual regulators in each one of those lines to supply pressure in case one of the regulators fails. We have dual relief valves in case both regulators on one side pop open. We try to make all the components dual because we can afford that kind of weight. But we can't afford the weight of two large engines. So we just make that engine as reliable as it can. Those engines basically are very reliable. They're nothing but a big cylinder with a flat plate and a bunch of holes drilled in the flat plate. Now, it's sort of like black magic to design those holes so that the engines don't blow up. And we had a lot of trouble with that ASN engine. It failed a number of tests, and we changed contractors on the design of the injector face where these holes are to make sure that the thing wouldn't fail when we got it up in flight. Now, we don't just light the engines up and see if they're going to blow up. We do things to aggravate them. And we have a system of tests, which we call bomb tests, where we place a small explosive device in the chamber of an engine. We'll light the engine and let it run for a while. Then we'll set that bomb off in there, which causes a great big pressure wave to bounce back and forth across the thrust chamber. And then if it amplifies, the engine will come apart. If it damps itself out and goes away, that means that we can take a small explosion in an engine without the thing disintegrating. It'll cure itself. So we direct our efforts in making the pieces of equipment that we can carry as reliable as possible. Your best. I've tried to do my best, and I think that when I do get old and decrepit, I still want to see that flag up there waving the way it ought to wave. Thanks a lot.